Hello, everyone, and welcome to Food Safety Matters, the podcast for food safety professionals. I'm Stacey Atchison, publisher of Food Safety Magazine, and I'm here with Barbara Van Renterham, editorial director, and Tiffany Mayberry, digital editor of the magazine. So here's what we've got for you today. A little bit of news and trends that's got some fun stuff in the mix, and then the interview. In this episode, Barbara talks with Ben Chapman. Some of you may know Ben as a co-host of the podcast Food Safety Talk, or as a contributor to the very popular Barf blog. Ben is associate professor and food safety extension specialist at North Carolina State University, where he uses reality-based research to investigate behaviors and creates interventions aimed at amateur and professional food handlers, managers, and organizational decision makers, the gatekeepers of safe food. Ben's position in the market gives him a really unique perspective on food safety, and one that we're sure you'll find of interest. And one last note, as we've mentioned before, Tiffany is going to be out on maternity leave soon. She'll be back with us for our November episodes. And that sounds like such a long time. And even though Tiffany's just a wee bit of a thing, she has some pretty big shoes to fill when it comes to being our digital and social editor. So we hope that we hold it together for you till you get back, Tiffany. And we also can't wait to hear what that baby's name is, which I've just started calling her TBD Mayberry.
Or Baby Mayberry, like everyone else calls her.
You like Baby Mayberry? Yeah, okay. Baby or TBD Mayberry. we'll miss you, Tiffany.
Miss you guys too.
All right. How about you want to get us into the news now?
Sure. Let's start with some documents that have been recently put out by the FDA. So earlier this month, FDA released three new guidance documents to help clarify FSMA regulations for a few different food categories. Low acid canned foods, juice, and seafood. FDA hopes the new documents will help food producers more clearly understand which parts of the FSMA rules apply to them and how the rules might affect their business operations. There's also another new guidance document that explains a waiver to the sanitary transportation rule and how it applies to establishments that sell food for humans and those that sell both human and animal food. We'll be sure to link to all of these guidance documents in our show notes for today's episode. Next month, the General Assembly of the United Nations plans to discuss the possibility of establishing a World Food Safety Day. The goal will be to increase awareness of foodborne illness across the world and to push governments, food industry, and consumers to do what they can to prevent these illnesses. The idea for an annual World Food Safety Day first came up at a 2016 conference held by the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. So far, the idea has gained international support from Argentina, Costa Rica, Estonia, and Venezuela. So far, if the plan goes forward, World Food Safety Day will be observed annually on June 7th.
Woo-woo! I'm sorry. I'm excited to see what kind of educational campaign is going to accompany this, because I think it's a really great idea.
I hope this happens. I do. So we'll keep an eye on that.
All right, and moving into one of our more fun topics today, Sports Illustrated recently put out a report ranking a number of Major League Baseball stadiums based on their health inspection records. Altogether, the magazine analyzed data from 28 ballparks across the U.S. and in Canada. The parks were ranked based on very specific criteria, including violations, critical violations, food safety ratings, as recorded within each inspection report, food entity type, and time frame. Based on Sports Illustrated's findings, the top three baseball stadiums in terms of food safety were Safeco Field, home of the Seattle Mariners, Fenway Park, home of the Boston Red Sox, and Minute Maid Park, home of the Houston Astros. At the bottom of the list were Oriole Park, home of the Baltimore Orioles, the Oakland Coliseum, home of the Oakland A's, and Tropicana Field, home of the Tampa Bay Rays. Sports Illustrated did say that some of the health departments that perform stadium inspections insist that baseball fans should not jump to conclusions too soon. However, they do warn that stadiums with multiple health violations across their entire venue should be approached with caution. Sports Illustrated also said that more than likely, repeat violations most likely stem from a lack of food safety training. The entire list of all 28 ballparks ranked from best to worst will be available in our show notes for today's episode.
Well, I have to say that baseball fans will not be disappointed if they access this article, because there's actually two articles that are linked. You can get to that from our show notes to the Sports Illustrated page. So there's no shortage of information in typical baseball fashion. But well, I live in Los Angeles, so of course I'm a Dodger fan, and I'm, you know, riding high pretty much this year with our, you know, current average of 712. You know, we've waited a long time for this. I can't help, we all approach this list, even though it's a food safety list, as baseball fans. So I don't know, it's like competitive, you know. Well, the Dodgers were at least better than, you know, another team. And Adam was happy that the Yankees beat the Dodgers. So, and Barbara, I'm sure you are happy that
the
Sox beat the Dodgers.
Well, what I did with this list is I looked at the teams that I follow, of course, and so I will root for the Red Sox unless they're playing Cleveland,
who as a matter of fact,
Cleveland and Detroit didn't make the list because public health officials there didn't bother to send the data. But the take home is that you can have a Fenway Frank, but not a Dodger dog. So I'm sorry, Stacey. And my National League team is the Rockies, which were fourth. Yeah. So, you know, I'm riding pretty high on this list.
Well, dare I share that I'm a vegetarian, and so, you know, I have the veggie dogs at Dodger Stadium, which, you know, I was very grateful when they started breaking those out, because it kept me at least in the, quote, ballpark of concession enjoyment. So, yeah, I don't know. Training, huh? Cross-contamination, sanitation, it just seems like you know, basic food safety training and time and temperature. So I don't know, maybe fundamentals, just like in baseball, let's get our fundamentals down and we'll be just fine. So, but it was a fun story. We thought you guys would enjoy it. So click away.
And moving on to another fun topic, each year a team of undergrad and grad students at Clemson University, with the help of food scientist Paul Dawson, research a new topic related to our dirtiest food habits. Their research really helps us to gauge how dirty some of our eating habits really are. So what habits have they looked at? I'll go through the list and we can kind of talk about some of these. So they have researched so far double dipping, the 5-second rule, blowing out candles on a birthday cake, the ever so popular college gang of beer pong, sharing a bucket of popcorn, garnishing drinks with lemon slices, and picking up dirty menus at restaurants.
Where to start?
Where do we start? Maybe the double dip, because the infamous double dip. I loved it that they brought, you know, Seinfeld into this one.
Well, I was a little discouraged that salsa seemed to transmit bacteria better than the other dips they looked at. But, you know, in my house, everyone gets their own bowl. So it doesn't matter if you double dip. You're just getting your same bacteria right back at you.
Well, the general theme here seems to be, you know, keep in mind if you're well or not, right? That seems to be one of the fine points here to keep in mind. You know, if you're sick, maybe you shouldn't be dipping at all, let alone double dipping. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Well, I have
the 5-second rule. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I was just going to say, out of all of these, I'm skipping straight down the list to the one that grosses me out the most. And that would have to be lemon slices and drinks. I absolutely cannot have lemon in my water and anything that I'm drinking. Those bartenders' fingers, just, I don't need them. No.
In your drink.
Not at all. I'll pass.
Yeah, yeah. And the 5-second rule, I mean, even when we were kids, did any of us actually believe the 5-second rule, you know?
I did.
They do go into great, I still do. I guess, you know, we still do. They talk to Don Shafter in this, who says, you know, it depends on what it is and where it lands, right? So... there's right. a lot to be said for that, but in general, it's sort of like, yeah.
Well, I have a couple funny thoughts about this. The first is that you know how I am with these studies that we report on. I go back and look at the actual study and the data, and once again, they spread Salmonella bacteria on a surface.
I saw that.
Drop stuff on it, and then saw, you know, okay. You know, maybe my floor would be worse than the spread Salmonella. I don't know. But, you know, I think legitimately to do it on, you know, go to a graduate student kitchen and do the experiment. You know, that would be more informative, I think. But years ago, my son William in school was asked to give an example of irony. And he came home and told me this. He said, my mom... who's the editor of Food Safety Magazine, but she believes in the 5-second rule. So that was his presented example of irony. So Tiffany, just watch out. Things will come back to bite you. But, you know.
I don't even want to.
I drop it on the floor. I rinse it off. You know, whatever.
I don't even want to get started on beer pong, though. I never did play beer pong, but the whole thing just sounds, you know. It doesn't, no.
Yeah.
So all I could say is no.
Pretty gross.
I was confused because, you know, in my day we played quarters. It wasn't
well, that would have
ping
to be
pong
worse.
Ball thing. So,
money?
Well, yes, the money would be worse, but this generation uses ping pong balls. Yeah. So yeah. There you go.
Anyway, we thought once again that this would be fun, and so we're... we've got links to that. We'll link to that in the show notes, right, Tiffany? Because we didn't post that on the website.
No, we didn't. Yeah, so if you're interested in reading more about any of these stories and all of our other news, you can always visit us online, foodsafetymagazine.com. You'll want to visit our podcast page. And if you're on Twitter, be sure to follow us at foodsafetymag.
All right. So now we're going to hear Barbara's conversation with Dr. Ben Chapman, Associate Professor and Food Safety Extension Specialist at North Carolina State University. With the goal of less foodborne illness, his group designs, implements, and evaluates food safety strategies, messages, and media from farm to fork. His areas of expertise are consumer, retail, and food safety culture, home food preservation and communicating food safety risk reduction messages. His programs and initiatives include food safety info sheets, which are one-page food safety-related information directed at food handlers, a food safety culture program at North Carolina State University, and Master Food Volunteer Program. Ben co-hosts a biweekly podcast called Food Safety Talk and tries to further engage folks online through Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, and maybe, not surprisingly, Pinterest. I am a little bit surprised about Pinterest, but I guess once you start and think about it, it's a good place to reach consumers.
You know, when you first introduced Ben at the top of the episode and mentioned Barf Blog, I've had this like mental audio of retching sounds in my head ever since. That's what comes to mind when I hear Barf Blog. But, you know, my interview with Ben was really great. He has a lot of great stories about what he does working in extension service. And I find that he's really dedicated to getting these important food safety messages out to the public. He has a lot of really innovative ideas for doing so.
Yeah. And I do think this is a little bit of a, you know, his position is unique in the market. And it's a great perspective. It's a little bit different from what we've been covering, but it's so important because the rubber really meets the road when it comes to consumers and to talk to somebody who's really fine tuning how to reach out and what is it, you know. Anyway, it's a great interview. You guys are going to enjoy it. So stay tuned. We're going to hear that interview now.
Hi, Ben. It's great to have you on our podcast today.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, let's get started. So you're an associate professor and food safety extension specialist at North Carolina State University. So what the heck does an extension specialist typically do?
If I could answer that question, it'd be great for me as well. My focus area is largely in retail, food service, and consumer food safety. And as an extension specialist, my job really is to support extension agents. That's the title that they have in our state. In other states, it's extension educators who are located in North Carolina in every county, and they are the boots on the ground individuals that work directly with a lot of businesses, with consumers on sort of food safety and food preservation practices, and also with like schools and farmers markets and small businesses that are catering and trying to get into small business food processing. And so my a lot of what I do is either research that helps support that world or develop extension programs or materials that also people can use. And I also work, not unlike some of my other colleagues who are food safety extension specialists across the U.S., but I, sometimes work directly with, businesses, depending on what their issues are and whether it, whether it's, hey, we need someone to help us train our staff, or if it's a larger, maybe more in-depth question on we have a problem with one of our products, or we have a problem regulatory-wise, and we need someone to help sort this out. So, I every day is a little bit different, and a lot of what I do is kind of look at hazards and try to translate some of that information for someone who doesn't have a technical background, and then work with. Businesses and other folks on solutions. And it's not even always businesses. We just recently done some work with a food bank group here in North Carolina who's starting to build a garden that they outside of the food bank that they'd like to, and by garden, I mean, it's like a couple of acres they want to actually farm. And so they're like, how do we do this safely? And so we work with them on stuff like that.
Oh, that's great. So I take it that most of the time businesses or growers come to you or come to Extension for resources instead of the other way around.
Yeah, often that's the case. There are times where it is the other way around. And I worked on a project earlier this year with a colleague in our vet college on agritourism sector folks that might have like livestock as well as you pick strawberries. So they may have like goats for a petting zoo on the same site as you pick strawberries. And in that case, I had a student last year sort of scour the internet to find businesses that fit that criteria. And then we invited them to be part of a project as well as some workshops, and they didn't maybe even know that we had resources in this area. So, I mean, largely it is sort of responsive, but every once in a while, depending on something that we might be interested in or something we determine is like an emerging issue, we may seek folks out and try to, bring them in the fold.
How does it work to let businesses know that you exist and your resources exist?
I might be in a unique situation. So about just over 10 years ago, I co-started Barf Blog with my then advisor and now colleague Doug Powell, and Barf Blog, for you know, for whatever reason, has created a little bit of some brand recognition for us out right. there. So yeah, so often I you know people may come across it and not sort of realize that it's you know something that's you know hosted at NC State and that I'm sort of part of. So I think that helps bring folks along, because it does have, especially in the food service and regulatory world, has you know quite a decent following. When it comes to extension, I'm really lucky that I'm in a state that historically extension has been extremely strong, and especially not even, especially once you leave the urban centers, it has this like, I don't know, historic importance. So, talking like you're from NC State or from NC State Extension, carries some weight. So usually folks are pretty, pretty aware.
That's great. When you were talking about the U-Pick fruit and the petting zoo, there's one not too far from me. And I always wonder at places like that, how involved they are in, with local services and educating themselves about what risks they might bring about by providing that type of environment.
Yeah, it's one of these things where, I think if there's been an incident, locally, whether that means within the state or even closer, there often is some level of awareness. But without those incidents that get coverage, you often get businesses that just aren't sort of aware that there even are hazards associated with it. Right. We as part of that agritourism project, we did a survey with some of the participants, and some of them had not even heard that there were ever illnesses linked to petting zoos. Which, I mean, I've been in this world for 15 years, and we've had a couple of major petting zoo outbreaks in our state. One with a few years ago, tragically, a little boy died, and one that was sort of made national attention that was linked to our state fair about a decade ago. And it's kind of fascinating that there's a lack of awareness that this stuff even happens.
Right. I kind of wonder where these people are, that they're not paying attention, particularly the ones that are in charge of these places, and they should be aware of the risks involved. So education maybe needs to be a target.
Yeah, and I think part of what Extension's got a lot of fantastic situations, but over time, in reaching audiences that weren't there historically, agritourism is different in my experience so far, is really different from traditional agriculture. You may have some individuals that grew up in urban areas that have returned to where their family was originally and have started this like petting zoo thing. And so they don't maybe have an individual historic connection to the traditional world of extension and agriculture. Mm-hmm. And we're really good at, and I say we, I mean, extension is really good at keeping on those traditional lines. Like, there's commodity group meetings and there's, associations. But when you have emerging niche type markets, we're not an organization that is always really quick to recognize that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at NC State's Extension Master Food Volunteer Program, and I wondered what your involvement is with this, and if you could describe the program for us.
Yeah, absolutely, and thanks for taking a look at it. I work to support a colleague. Her name's Dara Bloom. She's an associate or an assistant professor in my department. She focuses on local food systems and sociology of of local foods, essentially. And she's developed a program to engage volunteers around, best practices around procuring food, working with local foods, and including that is a food safety component. So my group was part of the design and training of many volunteers over the last little while as we've piloted this program, and we focus on things like home food preservation. It's an area where volunteers are quite interested in, but also things like church dinners the idea of training individuals who will become food handlers or managers or whatever the terminology is in those community events, but they're not there as like commercial people, and so a lot of that Extension Master Food Volunteer Program from a food safety standpoint is like, here are the things that you should know in these events and how to control, hazards and manage the risks of people that are participating.
That's great. I started a few years ago making a lot of jam, and I went to USDA's site just to familiarize myself with what I really needed to know. Not that I wanted to poison family or anything, but so those, I would have been, at one of your sessions on that, because I have a couple beech plum trees that are very prolific. So I make a lot of jam. I read an interview of your account of how you got even in the door in the food safety area. And I would love to hear it in your own words, how that came about.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So it really goes back to high school. When I was a kid, I was sort of enamored with the area of infectious diseases. And that sounds really nerdy and maybe a little bit creepy. But I was, quite interested in like popular movies in the early 90s and mid 90s, like Outbreak. And there was this fantastic book that was like, fictional, but kind of had this feel to it that it was real, called The Hot Zone, about the Ebola outbreak. And I really, that coupled with a really excellent high school biology teacher, it got me looking at food, not just food, but disease. And I went to a university in Canada, the University of Guelph, that was known for food systems and agriculture. And I had at that time, I had no real interest in that. I just wanted to know about molecular biology and genetics. And I had a big interest in viruses and just the historical like nature of what, the plague and wiping people out and that kind of stuff. And that kind of, I guess, fortuitously connected with, Doug Powell, who I mentioned before, we started Barfblog together, who was at that time a professor at the University of Guelph, who was researching risk and risk communication around food systems. And I didn't know anything about him and was like an undergraduate who didn't really pay attention to a lot of stuff and really just wanted to hang out with my friends and drink beer, but was interested in this field of biology. And I wasn't a fantastic student at all. But I was looking for a summer job, and mainly because I wanted to stay in this town and play baseball with a bunch of friends that I had, and it was a cool place to live. Another friend of mine had worked for Doug the previous year and said, you guys would probably get along. He's looking for some research assistants this summer. So I just emailed him, and he hired me without meeting me. His background also, I guess, ironically, is in molecular biology and genetics. And the first day that I showed up, he's like, okay, I need you to come in at about 6:30. And what your job this summer is really to do track media stories around food safety risks and animal agriculture risks and plant agriculture risks. And I didn't really understand why. And so I read I mean, for the first 3 or 4 weeks, I read a ton of news stories, which was fascinating to me, just like stuff that I'd never really even had a sense of before. And I was studying some of these things in, you know, in my school. But I just didn't really get a sense like, oh, people are really upset about genetic engineering, or, and this is in 2000, or people get sick from food like all the time. And so I just had this crash course of reading everything that's going on. Part of his goal was to get this information so he could put it out there through a listserv called FSNet. And I really, really loved it. And then right about a month into it, a really tragic outbreak hit Ontario. And it was an E. coli 0157H7 outbreak that was linked to a water system, a town called Walkerton, Ontario, and 7 people died. And you know, there are 3,000 people out of the, I don't know, 10,000 people that live there that got sick because this is the water that they drank every day. And it was just like a colossal mess of having people in charge of water treatment that didn't understand the consequences of falsifying records and not chlorinating and how disease, like, you know, just to unpack the entire thing of like how disease moves from wells into people's homes and how do you communicate that. And I happened to, you know, I mentioned that I wanted to play baseball with a bunch of guys that I knew. Six of the guys that I was playing with that summer were from this town, and they, you know, like their families were sick. And so all of a sudden it became like, all right, I really am interested in disease. And now I know people that were affected by this, and I was pretty much, hooked. And I stayed on with Doug and did a master's degree in, focusing on greenhouse vegetable production and food safety. It's not like I got bored, but I wanted to have different experiences. And so my PhD was focused in, retail food service and hand washing and cross contamination. And so I got, you know, exposed to a different part of the food sector, through that. But it really was just like, you know, an interest in disease and then seeing those real life public health impacts with individuals that I knew. And I was like, man, there's, you know, the more I was exposed to it, the more I realized how large the magnitude of food safety and waterborne safety was.
Yeah. Not unlike people who go into various research on various diseases, if that disease happens to affect their family, they have more motivation to do research in that area.
Yeah, so. Absolutely.
Now, jumping ahead a little bit, earlier this year, you gained a little notoriety, shall we say, with some research you participated in on instructions in celebrity cookbooks. And it's nice in a way that was able to trigger some conversations about food safety, but take us through what happened there.
Sure. So I have a fantastic extension associate who works as part of my program. Her name's Katrina Levine. Katrina's background is she's a registered dietitian and has her master's in public health and in nutrition. And she came to my program a couple of years ago when we were looking for a part-time person to help with, you know, develop extension materials. A couple of years into that, Katrina, you know, we worked together on a lot of things, and she had sort of shared that she is very interested in how people learn how to cook and where they get their information, and not just from a food safety standpoint, but from a nutrition standpoint and where they procure food. Like, how does someone develop their ideology on what they do in the kitchen or at the grocery store? And so we sort of got talking about messages and where, you know, where each of us learn to cook and what gets us excited about foods. And so this conversation about cookbooks kind of came up, and we hatched this idea of, well, let's look at cookbooks from a food safety standpoint and what's in there. And, you know, if that's a place we know from some surveys that are out there that people self-report that they look at cookbooks, for, you know, food inspiration. And so we're like, well, if they're looking there, what kind of food safety messages are there? Are they correct? Are they incorrect? Are they safe? Do they really talk about, food safety at all? And so, we designed a study to look at, New York Times bestsellers for a specific point in time over a holiday season a couple of years ago, thinking, you know, that's what we could find on sales. That's when people buy cookbooks to give them as gifts. So this should be the most, you know, a snapshot in time of, a couple of years of these are the things that people are looking at. And so her task was to go through each of these cookbooks and define what would make, you know, for inclusion in the study and you know, then review recipes for specific food safety messages. And we had sort of this whole coding scheme. And the big sort of answer that she found sort of overall was only about 8% of the time when you have a recipe that includes a raw animal protein that has a specific measurable safe endpoint temperature, was there actually a temperature there? And so, you know, you've got this like 92 to 93% of the time when someone goes to a cookbook, there's just no message. And so that was the story for us. And so NC State put out a press release and it got picked up, by the UK tabloids. And really all the interviews that Katrina and I did around this had, you know, that our finding was of interest to them, but not nearly as much of interest as what did Gwyneth Paltrow say in her cookbooks. And so we happened to have, you know, one of those bestsellers was a Gwyneth Paltrow book. And so we, as it happens in interviews, you say, okay, well, you know, here's my message that this is a big deal overall, and it's not just about Gwyneth Paltrow. And they're like, yeah, but what about Gwyneth Paltrow? So we gave a couple of examples of poor recipes from Gwyneth Paltrow's website, and I shared this with Don Schaffner on our podcast, the whole story. And my mistake was I received, you know, the tabloid researchers were like incessant, and they're like, we're on deadline, we need this right now. And I went to the restroom, and as you know, as people do, was on my phone while I was, you know, multitasking, let's say. And I was like, okay, you want something? Let me find something right now. And so I just like went to her website and found a recipe that, you know, that exemplified no endpoint temperature for chicken. And so that information went to the researcher. They sent that on to Gwyneth Paltrow's people. And they responded, you know, back through the researcher, well, that study wasn't even in the, you know, that recipe wasn't even in the study. The book that you had in the study, there are recipes in there that do have endpoint temperatures. And so then I was like, okay, fine, I'm out of the bathroom. Let me get to my computer and go look at the raw data. And so then I found 7 recipes from the book in the study that didn't have endpoint temperatures. And the one that they suggested had an endpoint temperature also had really bad messaging on, like, you should wash your chicken, which we know can only spread, you know, Campylobacter and Salmonella throughout right. the kitchen. So I kind of was like, yeah, okay, I made a little mistake on using this example, but let me give you a bunch of other examples that were in the book. And that story, that byplay between the two groups, became like front page news on the, you know, the Times in the UK, and like Food and Wine picked it up. And for like 2 days, we were famous. and people were talking about food safety, and then it all evaporated.
I know that I love to watch cooking shows. And one particular show I watched focused on a restaurant in Connecticut. Now, I'm up in Massachusetts, so I don't live too far. I'd never heard of this restaurant, but they showed a video of these vertical, I don't even know what you would call them, like a vertical grill for cooking hamburgers. And you can see the stuff from the top burgers dripping down on the bottom and how busy it is during lunch. And you know that these things aren't being cleaned properly. And so I went to the website of the show that had focus this. And I, you know, try and do my part explaining why this is not, you know, so good from a food safety perspective. And what I heard from people, and this is when I stopped watching this show, was, well, they grind their meat fresh.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, oh, that's magical. Even worse. How often are they cleaning a grinder? It made my head explode. But even trying to have conversations with people, it's amazing how emotional, you know, food is, and people draw a line in the sand, and you really can't get past that. Do you find that when you're trying to engage people with the messaging that you're doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think food's really emotional, right? And because it's part of your upbringing, and that, you know, one of the reasons why I find it so fascinating to work with sociologists who work on food is just the study of that, on the cultural, the family connection, and no one, you know, I hate to use absolutes as a scientist, but very few people want to hear that they're doing something that's unsafe or risky. And so often it gets rationalized as, well, I've kind of always done it this way, or that's not something that we worry about, or no, you've got the risk wrong. The real risk is this, and I'm managing that risk. And I think that part of the challenge that we have in food safety is, you know, we got pretty good data on lots of things. Like, we know about time temperature controls, and we know about cross contamination, and none of these things are absolutes. Like, it's not like everyone who cross contaminates a burger, like in this vertical grill, which I just found online, is going to get sick. But it increases the risk of someone getting sick, and that conversation about risk is difficult to translate sometimes, mm-hmm. because it's a mathematics thing, and we're only really clear on the experiences that we have. And so, you know, I've had similar experiences like what you've described, talking with businesses that are like, look, we test all of our 100% of our beef to ensure that there is no E. coli in it. And we, you know, we grind our own, and how, look at us, how could we be dirty? How could we be the source of a foodborne illness? All the people that you're talking about are worse than we are. That's a challenge. You and I both, you know lots of people in the food safety world. I get really excited with some of my colleagues in a good way, who are the ones that might work for a business that are constantly saying, we're not bad, but holy crap, there's a lot of stuff that we could do better, or I want to find the pathogen before someone else does, not let's not look for it. And so the more, you know, the more individuals that we have who are sort of flipping that discussion within the food industry, I think we will see progress. But so for so long, the idea has been, no, there's no problem here, or we know how to manage it. Just, you know, don't ask these questions. And I think, you know, in the 15 years that I've been in it, I think I've seen a switch, or at least a shift maybe in that perception. But that being said, when you look at an independent restaurant operator who's not thinking food safety day in, day out, I can see where it's really easy to rationalize that, oh, well, we've never had a problem, so, you know, right. you're just being a nerd.
Now, the company that told you they tested 100% of their product, then they would have nothing to sell.
Right.
Do they make the connection? And then, of course, in my brain, I hear Bill Sperber saying, you know, you got to test the process, not the product. So,
yeah.
I'm not sure how you connect the dots for these people.
I think, and so, you know, a lot of my background and a lot of how I attack this problem of food safety is from a communications standpoint. And I think, if we look to historic literature and risk communication, a lot of it's been done not with individuals who are managing risk, but it is with individuals who are deciding on technology or trying to figure out what to do in their own home. I think we have to take a risk communication approach. And we, I say we, our world of food safety communicators or educators, for the most part, doesn't really take cues from what risk communication kind of says, which is you can't be patronizing. You can't tell people that they're wrong. You have to, you know, telling stories works better than statistics. Mathematics is hard.
Oh, see, Don wouldn't like that. He's the stats guy, right?
Well, no, but so Don's like I think a very unique individual who understands all of that stuff. It comes at it from how do I translate the math,
right?
And I think does it in a way, that's been really successful. Whether that's with the public or with a business, kind of say, okay, here are your gray areas. And there are no absolutes, but here's what the math is showing. Here's what the modeling is showing, mm-hmm. and you've got to make a decision based on that.
Right.
But for a long time, and you still see it with some of the messages out there. It is very much like, well, they've got it wrong, and we as scientists, we know what we're talking about, and that approach really doesn't work to change behavior very well.
Right. Now you mentioned about that part of the work and the research that you're doing is about generating messages for retailers and processors and consumers. So if you had to summarize what your main message is to each of these groups, what would those be?
There are hazards, and those hazards aren't 100% prevalent, but you need to know kind of about the prevalence of them to pick the right thing to control those hazards. But I would start with, there are hazards, and no food is zero risk because of that. And here are the hazards that a food microbiologist would see if they looked at your system. I'll give you. When I was doing my PhD, I knew very little about the food service world. I didn't work in it at all as a teenager. I cut grass, and which was awesome. When I was trying to figure out how to research this area, I had a couple of mentors that really pushed, like, well, go get it in the system, go figure it out. So I went and volunteered as a dishwasher in a restaurant for about like 3 months. Not every day, a few days a week, I would get up and go and wash dishes from the night before, and I would be there through the lunch service. And I learned stuff. I mean, this is anecdotal, but I learned stuff about how people saw hazards. The chef in that restaurant knew that I was a food safety guy because it was a place that had a bar that we used to, like, our whole lab used to go hang out at. And we talked. That's how I let them, got in there to let me volunteer. But early on in my first couple of weeks, he held up this like commercial can opener. And said, this is the riskiest thing in my kitchen. Like, this is unprompted. I didn't ask him, hey, what's the riskiest thing in your kitchen? And I look at this kitchen, I'm like, oh, you got a lot of raw meat here. You have a small area. You're splashing things all around. I see lots of risks. But this is the thing that he said was the most riskiest thing. And I was like, oh, okay, why? Because I, like, not just like I'm interviewing him, but I really didn't get it. And he's like, well, because botulism in canned foods is a problem. And if there was botulinum toxin on this can opener, and I don't clean it right, then everybody's getting botulism. And I was like, wow, okay, that's pretty, that's a different hazard and risk that I would have identified as someone who studies this world. But that was from, his training was in the late 70s when we talked about botulism a lot.
Right.
And he hadn't stayed updated with, at this time, let's look at produce and food safety. Like, he didn't look at his lettuce at all as ever being potentially a source of an outbreak. And I would look at it and go, that's your most likely source.
Right. Right. So I'm wondering, through all of your research, if you think that current food safety messaging is effectively communicating risk to consumers, and if not, what do we as an industry need to do differently?
I think Yeah. So no, I don't think it effectively communicates the risk. And I guess more importantly to me, it doesn't convince anybody that they should practice anything different and that it, would create some sort of a behavior change response. I think the reason why the messages out there right now are not fantastic are because they're really generic. And I look at, the core four messages of cook, chill, clean, and separate. Separate's really hard. It doesn't what does that mean? It's really about cross contamination. Why don't we say don't cross contaminate? But also
it wouldn't fit in the little box that they show for that message. Right.
Yeah. Right. And then it's like, well, what should I separate? Like it's, I think we really, as we go forward in this, if we look to cues from other industries, from the or other sectors, nutrition, seat belts, cigarettes, they looked at one or two actions and they got really specific. I've been part of this USDA grant that's focused on sugar toxin producing E. coli in beef. And we had the chance with some of our outreach dollars to create an ad campaign and go through from start to finish. And we focused on like one thing. And it's super specific. It is 160 degrees Fahrenheit is the safe temperature to cook a ground beef patty. Like that type of messaging tells a consumer, we think, and we're testing this now, but tells a consumer what to do. It doesn't get things all messed up like, well, what do I do with turkey, or what if it's a lamb burger, or whatever it is. Like, we need other messages for those other things. But if we look at sort of public health risks, we have to get super specific and put it into context for people. Why? And I mean, one of the most common things that comes up in any either conversation I have with just the guys I play hockey with or anybody who is interviewing me for consumer type messaging is like, well, why can't I cook my steak rare and not my ground beef? And just that, like, to be able to dive into the intricacies of why ground's different and, external contamination ending up in the middle. And if right. It's a whole muscle meat, all the nuances stuff, you don't get that from cook. Like, it really is too sanitized, too generic for me. And I think that's where we've got to start being much more specific with our messages.
I know that, and this is no dig against ThermoPen. I own several of them. Sent an email recently about, correctly, initially, was that you needed to take the temperature of the meat instead of just looking at the color. But then they had messaging about, well, you can drop the temperature down, but then you have to cook it 10 seconds longer. And I said, this really isn't going to solve the problem, because no consumer is going to stand there with a stopwatch, nor do most of them use a thermometer. I mean, at the recent IAFP, we learned that probably half of food safety professionals don't even use a meat thermometer. So I took a little issue with them and had some emails going back and forth. And they were very, very stringent about, well, as long as you do it for this time. And I thought, but is that the messaging that the consumer's going to take away? The message that the consumer is going to take is that, oh, I can cook it to only 150. So even for a company that started to do it right, the messaging is a little bit fuzzy.
Well, and it can be confusing. I think, one of the other things that we have to keep in mind is that a consumer is not a consumer is not a consumer. I mean, the marketing companies know this. They use market segments, and there is a segment of the population that that I see online that read Life Hacker, the technology blogs that would look at that and say, you know what, I will get my thermometer and my stopwatch out. And so if we can arm those individuals with the right messages and then arm other individuals with a slightly different message, It's and then be able to explain the science behind all of that stuff. Like this, that's the thing that I think social media has allowed us to do is a brochure is no longer, you don't have this one direction chance of like, let's get a message out there. Like we do have lots of chances for further engagement with people. If you can be compelling and get them to investigate further, there is a segment of the population that's going to do that. And then you're exactly right. There's another segment of the population that's just like, tell me what temperature I need to cook it to. And why can't I just look to make sure it's not pink? Why? What is that? What's that all about? I think we need more messages as opposed to less, and we can't simplify them for everybody. And the people that get really excited about this stuff are the ones that seem to want more information on the why and the science.
What do you do with the people who are just afraid of the science, don't understand it, have no interest in learning about it? I think GMOs here.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So GMOs isn't just about the science. There's this whole social aspect of it as well that entire conversation gets wrapped up in that. It's about controlling the food system. It's about not being, information's not shared. Not everybody knows what's happening. And so we can't just hit people with science. You have to figure out all of those other things as well as part of the messaging, because the concerns aren't just about, is this safe or not? It's they're all kind of wrapped up together, and regulation is wrapped up. There is an increasing distrust of science. I think that part of the reason that continues to exist is because we as scientists haven't done a really great job talking about uncertainty, and we want people we want people to believe us, and then we give them absolutes, and those absolutes aren't true. So we look at GMOs as, are they a risky food? No, I mean, they're really, really tested. Is it zero risk? No, it's not zero risk, but I'd say it's really, 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 really small. And if we compare it to other foods, it's way less risky because of that.
Right.
I think for the last 20 years, we've really focused on, no, it's not an issue. I think it's been really interesting. Don and I talked about this on our podcast, that Campbell's, their kind of argument with GMA over labeling and just like, industry stance and them breaking away. When I was in grad school, Doug had this project where, this is 2001. He worked with a farmer's market, and a farmer who owned this market grew sweet corn and potatoes that were genetically engineered, and they labeled everything and sort of said, here's why I use this. And then the genetically engineered stuff outsold the conventional stuff. So it's like fascinating, the more you tell people, and especially when you get into transparency, it seems to matter.
Right. I agree. So you've brought up the podcast that you do with Don a couple times, Food Safety Talk. Describe what motivated the two of you to start this, and what, if any, feedback you guys typically receive on your efforts.
Yeah, so on Food Safety Talk, it really started from Don. I've known Don for a long time as a student. I ran a seminar series at the University of Guelph where I invited Don to come talk and talk about modeling, and I got to hang out with him, and we've become a lot, good friends. And at the IAFP 100th anniversary, NPR StoryCorps cataloged a whole bunch of, discussions as sort of like this oral history of IAFP. And at the end of that, we recorded for half an hour. Don kind of said, it's like, I know about this world of podcasts, and what we just did kind of feels like a podcast. And this is this growing media, and it doesn't, take a lot of infrastructure to create something like this. And it's about like, instead of trying to fit our messages into traditional media, we just create our own channel. And if people want to know about food safety stuff, then maybe we can like create this. And so he turned me on to two or three podcasts that he had been listening to. And I was, you know, I got hooked just on the storytelling aspect of things. And I saw it from like, I was listening to them as I was driving to work or as I was at the gym. And I was like, man, there's something here. So we just kind of jumped in and tried it. And just really like figured out, okay, every couple of weeks we can talk for a while. And then when we started, we're like, oh, we'll do this for half an hour. And then it was like an hour long. And then we're like, well, we'll just do it until it's done. And so now, you know, we've got some episodes that are like 2 hours. We would do it even if no one listened to it. Cause now I've learned a lot about his perspective from, you know, the modeling standpoint. And it's just been like, you know, fascinating to be part of that. We just have fun and people like it's, you know, Barflog's got like 72,000 subscribers and we get about right now it's like 3,200 or 3,300 subscribers, to Food Safety Talk for every episode. And it's different people people have learned about Barflog through Food Safety Talk, or have come and been like, I have no idea. Like, you know, it's just a different sector of individuals who are interested in food safety that we weren't reaching just through the blog.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of what you do, in your job is to try and find unique ways to reach people who need to learn more about food safety.
Absolutely. I think you nailed it. And that's pretty much what I try and do.
Now, I noticed in your bio, you list that you do reality-based research. And I was curious, what you mean by that?
Well, yeah. So, a lot of my training was based on people lie in surveys or, you know, let me step back a little bit. A lot of what goes wrong in food safety issues are behaviors. It's actions. It's not using a thermometer. It's not washing hands when needed. And when we try to investigate, first of all, how often those inactions happen or how often they should happen and they don't, or that people do it incorrectly. If we ask people that, they either don't really get it all the time, exactly what we're asking about, or they lie because there's an area of social desirability. And so there was some, I would say like groundbreaking research that was published about 13 or 14 years ago from a group in Wales. Chris Griffith was the sort of head of the unit, but there are a lot of folks who looked at how do we actually like figure out what people are doing, not ask them about it. And they published some stuff that basically said, if we ask people what they do and then we go ahead and watch them, or we watch them and then ask them about what they just did, those two things don't match up. So they kind of set this like bar that I am in the school of, that we really need to watch what people do. And so for me, reality-based research is exactly that. My group uses a lot of observation or ethnography, where we're part of the system, to collect data about real actions. And so we've, you know, done stuff where we put up video cameras in commercial kitchens and watched hand washing and cross contamination. We've done multiple studies where we've posed data collectors as secret shoppers, either in grocery stores or in farmers markets or as patrons of a restaurant ordering hamburgers, and not just like asking a server, what would you tell me if I asked for an undercooked burger, but actually ordering that burger and then recording what they tell us.
Right.
And we have a project right now for USDA FSIS where we're observing consumers in model kitchens handle foods. Again, for the same reason, it's like, if we ask them what they do you use a thermometer? There's a portion of the population that's just going to tell you, yes, I do use the thermometer. But when we watch them, they don't, or they try to, but they use it incorrectly.
Hmm. I would love to be part of that research. I think that sounds like fun. Actually, when I go shopping, if I see someone like picking out a package of meat and they use one of the plastic bags to put the meat in, I will start up a conversation and tell them how great that is that they're doing that and start a conversation. And it's been really interesting to talk to these folks and see the reasons why they're doing that and what they know about food safety.
Absolutely.
It's really interesting. So Ben, as we wrap up today, what new projects are on the horizon for you down there in North Carolina?
Well, so for the last couple of years, we've done a lot of work in social media. And, you know, just like you said before, trying to figure out the best way to connect with people. And we see social media as an avenue for that. Right now we're trying to, use social media as a way to bring people into the fold as data collectors and use them for, not use them, but, engage them as citizen scientists. And you know, we've practiced some of this stuff actually as part of the NoroCore project on swabbing airplane bathrooms for norovirus and airport bathrooms. And, I had a student last year who, you know, similar in the reality research side of things, engaged with a bunch of high school students to take pictures of their thermometers on Thanksgiving and what temperature did it get to and where was it placed and what type of thermometer are they using. And I really see my group moving more into this area of how can we better engage with people so they can provide us much richer data on what
and honest data.
And honest data, right? Like, so I mean, the thing is with the pictures, there's like a photographic record, right? Like, here, just tell us where you put your thermometer and then take a picture so we can see what the temperature is. It's a lot harder to stage that than it is to actually do it, right? Like, oh, I know it's supposed to get to 165. At least their turkey got there. We know that. And I think the world of citizen scientists or citizen science is twofold, because it goes to that question you asked before about people trusting science. If we can engage people as part of the system and explain why we make decisions and why there's trade-offs and how a study is designed, you know, there's a thought that they'll value the process of the scientific inquiry more. So that's an area that we're moving into.
That's a great idea. I think for people to be able to take ownership of their role in that process, I think will make a big difference.
Cool.
So, well, Ben, it's been great talking to you today, and we'll have to have you back to update us on your ongoing research. Very interesting.
Sounds great. Barbara, thanks again for the invite. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks again to Ben Chapman for joining us on the podcast, and thanks to you for listening. You can follow Ben on Twitter. His handle is @BenjaminChapman. Be sure and check out our show notes for easy access to all the resources from this episode. You'll find those at foodsafetymagazine.com/podcast-episode-8. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe. When you subscribe to Food Safety Matters, new episodes appear in your feed as soon as they're posted. And who doesn't like simple? Please share your thoughts, write a review, or send us an email at podcast@foodsafetymagazine.com with your comments. Your feedback's really important to us. All right, that's it for us today. Our next episode will post on September 12th. We'll talk to you then.